The Glimpse.
I've read this poem a million trillion times and talked about it a million trillion times. Like, it's just like, it stirs me up, you know? Like, it just, it activates something inside me. The way that it is strange is like shaped exactly like the keyhole of my brain.
Welcome to The Glimpse. I'm your host, Camille Rankin. The keyhole to Kaveh Akbar's brain involves a dog, a hatchet, and a slight undercurrent of dread. He's a highly lauded poet, editor, a teacher, and author of the poetry collections Pilgrim Bell and Calling a Wolf a Wolf. We caught up with Kaveh at an airport lounge during a book tour for his debut novel, Murder. Kaveh is our guest today on The Glimpse. Kaveh Akbar writes in the language of someone who loves what language can make and what poems can make from their language. In his latest poetry collection, Pilgrim Bell, sound and sentence and fragment play across the breadth of the page, carrying us through their investigations of God, empire, identity, and the strange and sometimes difficult wonder of being alive. All the while, we see through the generous gaze of an eye wide open to both the divine and the mundane as they bask in the same warm stretch of light. Welcome, Kaveh. Thanks for being here.
That was gorgeous. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for seeing me and for your attention. That's not a small gift.
I'm happy that you feel seen. I always try. I'm so looking forward to talking to you about your poetry and your fiction. I mean, I know we're here to talk about your poetry, really, but you just published a novel and you're traveling now, reading from that, Martyr. And congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we met as poets years and years ago. And it's a funny thing to, I mean, I still very much think of myself as a poet. You know, people will come up to me and say, you know, I'm a writer, and I'll be like, oh, do you write poems or fiction, or, you know, what do you write? And they'll say poetry, and I'm like, ah, one of me, one of my tribe. And sometimes they'll say, oh, I write stories or I write novels, and I'm like, oh, that's dope. You know, I know novelists. You know, like, I still, I don't sit in that exactly yet.
Yeah. I think that when poets write prose, there's just so much attention to language, and I've really been enjoying that in your novel. The prose is so gorgeous. I'm like picky about that.
I appreciate
I'll be like, the prose is not really doing it for me.
No, 100%. I'm super quick to put a novel down. I think the opportunity cost of reading a novel is massive, right? And if I finish a novel, that in and of itself is like a pretty august mantle in my regard, because that means that it's held my attention for its duration.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're a terrific poet and you understand that even if you're writing a long poem, that doesn't mean that, you know, in the middle of the 10-page poem, your language can get slack, right? It's a long, you know, you're just lengthening the tightrope. And I feel like that was the novel for me, right? I still want to say things in their most irreducible way. I still want to say complicated things simply, right? But I can say 85,000 words instead of, you know, a sonnet or whatever.
Is that exciting for you, having that space to expand, or daunting?
It's both, but it was really fun to just have room to play. And that's what it felt like, was playing with my favorite toy in this new way. You know what I mean? Like, I had all these Legos, this language, right? And I had been using them to build like spaceships or whatever. And now I use them to build like a scale model of the earth instead. You know what I'm saying?
So let's talk about your poetry.
I'm sharing a poem called Reading Fedoxod in a Pandemic. This is the last poem that I wrote that made it into my second poetry collection, Pilgrim Bell. It was my COVID poem. You know, it was sort of the poem of my COVID moment. Over COVID, I was both learning how to write narrative and working on this narrative project, but I was also relearning Persian. It was my first language. I was born in Iran, but when we came to America, it sort of atrophied. My brother is 7 years older than me. And so when we got to America, he was really struggling in school. And so in a misguided but understandable effort to help him, my parents banned speaking Farsi in the household. And so, you know, our first language sort of withered a little bit. And so over quarantine, I had this Persian tutor with whom I met on Zoom, and I was working on learning Persian as I was processing this mass casualty event, you know, this global catastrophic death event. Yeah. So the title of this poem references Farrukh Ferrukhzad, who was one of the great Persian poets of the 20th century, one of the great Iranian poets. She's a little bit like Plath or Sexton in that she wrote a lot of really, really fiery poems about domesticity and femininity and motherhood that really kind of undermine the typical ways in which those things were spoken of in a patriarchal culture, right? And she also died very young, very tragically, like those two poets. And there's this sort of now weird obsession with her love life and, you know, who was her lover, and, you know, in exactly the same way with Plath and Sexton. So she's sort of that figure in Iranian poetry. So anyways, this poem is called Reading Ferrukhzad in a Pandemic. The title is a lie. I can't read Farsi. Maharche rake boyad as deste bashim as destatim. I can make out, we lose, we lose. I type it into a translation app. We have lost everything we need to lose. In between what I read and what is written, need everything. Here, the waving flag. Here, the other world. Because we need mail, people die. Because we need groceries, people die. I write, we need, knowing we dilutes my responsibility, like watercolors dipped in a fast river. Get behind me, English. When I text, Meharche roke boyad as deste bashim as destadim. To my dad, he writes back, we have lost whatever we had to lose. Hammering pentameter, whatever we have. People die because they look like him. My uncle jailed, his daughter killed. This is a real fact. Too wretched for letters. And yet, my uncle jailed, his daughter killed. Waving world, the other flag, there is room in the language for being without language. So much of wet is cold. So much of diamond is light. I want both my countries to be right to fear me. We have lost whatever we had to lose.
Thank you so much for reading that. It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about reading this is that about that translation that we land on at the end, we have lost whatever we had to lose. And I was thinking that it could mean that we lost whatever it was possible to lose, but also that it might be we lost whatever it was necessary to lose.
Yeah. Like whatever we needed to lose, we lost, right?
Yeah.
I love that duality. I love that it sits in both of those.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so interesting, because thinking about the poem and the context that it enters in the pandemic, and the deaths that you kind of talk about both in the world of the pandemic and maybe in the world of Iran as well. And that's kind of what I gleaned from the poem and thinking about, like, were those necessary losses? As you know what I mean? Who decides what we need to lose?
That's beautiful. The idea of one's mortality as being a thing that one has to lose is salient across all my work, you know, is an endless obsession of the novel, of this book, of the first book, in terms of, you know, if I'm going to give this away, to whom shall I give it? For what shall I give it? If one's mortality is taken away, where is the volition in it, right? If it happens, even if it happens naturally, to what extent is volition given, right? To what extent does consent play, you know?
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of, you know, thinking about mortality as something, I mean, something you have to lose ultimately. I mean, your life is something you do have to lose eventually.
Yeah.
And then thinking about the agency that may or may not come into that is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and none of us had agency in accepting it in the first place, right?
Yeah.
There's that famous line from Fences where he says, I gave you your life, I can take it away, right? The Denzel Washington character, mm-hmm. right? And that line in his mouth in the context of that play sounds very cruel. But, you know, if you believe in a capital G God who sits in a cloud stroking his beard, you know,
that's
then
definitely what God is doing for sure. One thing I was like going to ask about and that I enjoyed seeing was that you included Persian script in the poem, which actually happens elsewhere in your work as well. Mm-hmm. And I wondered for you, how do moments of non-English operate in poetry, like written in English, and what does it bring into the work for you?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And it's something that I've been interested in my whole sort of poetic life, I guess. You know, Eduardo Corral's Slow Lightning came out in 2004. I think I saw it early in my undergrad, but that was the first book that I ever saw that had long arrays of untranslated, unitalicized second language alongside the English, right?
That,
and it's hard for me to understate like the significance of that book on my own development as a poet. So I want to shout it out here. And then, you know, this poem is literally about me learning to read Farsi, which I never did. You know, it was my first language, but I spoke it as a little kid, right? So I was never reading it yet by the time we came to America. So reading Farsi, going from it being these tea leaves to it actually carrying lexical semantic data, right? Mm. Even like stripped of actually being able to translate anything, even just being able to sound out arrays of texts felt really thrilling to me. And Farsi and Arabic use basically the same alphabet. Farsi has a few extra letters. And so I wanted and have always been interested in having little shreds of that around, right? Because for a lot of the times a reader who doesn't speak or read Farsi will see it and feel the way that I felt for a lot of my life, right? Which is just like, looks cool, means nothing to me semantically, right? And then there are other readers who will see it and know, like actually be able to read it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then there are other readers who maybe speak Pashto or, you know, Arabic or, you know, Urdu, who will be able to sound it out. And so there will be like a sonic element for them, but not a denotative semantic element, right? And that's thrilling to me. Again, like that's those different valences of experience that different kinds of readers can have. There's no hegemony. There's it's not like one reading is more or less correct than the others, right? But the idea that you can hand a poem to 100 different people and they'll receive it 100 different ways, but to sort of create this moment that like really acts to sort of stratify those different readings is fun to me.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear you talk about that because I'm a little obsessed with how that can happen. It's just a crystallized moment in a poem where all these different doors open.
Yeah.
And depending on your relationship to that language, and they all have like a completely valid and really interesting and layered experience of the language, like feeling refused by it, feeling intrigued by it, not having access to it, or having some access, but it bringing up something for you. You know what I mean? I think that there's, and that always happens in language, but it's just such a literal moment of it happening on a page. And I love it.
Yeah. And I love what you say about that, about the doors and feeling excluded by it or feeling refused by it. Because if you're like waiting on the G train, you're going to hear a lot of languages that don't make any sort of semantic sense to you. And I feel like the experience of poetry, it's like the only art form that we sort of strap to a gurney and try to beat a confession out of. You know what I mean? Like I can play Ave Maria for my students and watch them get emotional, even though they don't speak the language, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We understand that sonic experience carries emotional data, right? Sonic experience can carry psycho-spiritual, metaphysical data, right? We understand this in every other form. Like we understand that a movie with no music is weird and uncanny and creepy, but a movie with different kinds of orchestration can feel triumphant, like John Williams, or can feel, you know, very unsettling. But like, for whatever reason, allowing a moment of poetry to just be like standing on that G train subway, you know, like, like people are like, what do I don't speak this. I can't read this. You know, it's like, that's, you don't have that with any other art form.
It's
you know
true.
What I mean?
It's true. And I think that, I enjoy elements of poetry that are like, outside of just the textual experience. So like not necessarily just about 100%. What the words are doing, but the experience of being in the poem. And I feel like, first of all, I always love it when an English speaker is kind of thrown off a little bit, like thrown off and reminded that like English is not the only language, like surprise.
Yeah.
And poems can speak to us in a lot of ways that aren't necessarily literal language, you know?
And how often do Americans actually feel uncentered in the global conversation? You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly.
Like in Iran, right? The feminist riots that were happening for the past several years, right? Everyone on social media was like, oh, what can I do to help? What can I do? And like every Iranian I know, all of my family was like, you stay over there. Like, this is our thing. Like, don't try to co-opt like our struggle. You know what I mean? And like the maybe well-intentioned, but ultimately sort of still American in their provinciality, sort of like ostensible allies or whatever, are like, well, but surely there's something we can do. And it's actually like, no, like just practice sitting on your hands for a second. Practice like just not being the center of this conversation for a second. Yeah.
That's a challenge.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to, it's sort of a tangent of a tangent, but.
But I'm here for it, honestly. Just have to sit with it. Something that we all need to learn sometimes, especially in this country.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't have to sit with it. There's moments, you know?
Yeah.
Well, let's take a little break.
We hope you're enjoying The Glimpse. It's just one small part of the Adrian Brinkerhoff Poetry Foundation.
We're the founders, Peter.
And Kathy Halstead. Our goal is to make poetry more accessible to everyone, and we do that in a variety of ways. Through partnerships, our film series, this podcast, and our website, brinkerhoffpoetry.org.
We hope these works will lure you into a parallel universe, the way a Möbius strip brings you into another dimension without leaving the page you're on. Thanks for listening.
So we're back.
We're back.
And we're going to talk about your inspiration poem. Do you want to tell us about it, or you can just jump in and read
Sure. Yeah. So Russell Edson's Neighborhood Dog is the poem that I thought of, or Russell Edson's The Neighborhood Dog. Sorry. It's an utterly strange poem. Russell Edson was in the school of kind of Daniil Carms or James Tate, of just writing these utterly uncanny little fable poems almost, or parable poems. Edson wrote mostly in prose poems too. And so they feel even more sort of like little enchanted, sometimes terrifying fairy tales. Truly uncanny. Maybe I'll read it and then we can talk about it. So this is Russell Edson's The Neighborhood Dog. A neighborhood dog is climbing up the side of a house. I don't like to see that. I don't like to see a dog like that, says someone passing in the neighborhood. The dog seems to be making for that second story window. Maybe he wants to get his paws on the sill. He may want to hang there and rest, his tongue throbbing from his open mouth. Yet in the room attached to that window, the one just mentioned, a woman is looking at a cedar box. This is, of course, where she keeps her hatchet, in that same box, the one in this room, the one she is looking at. That person passing in the neighborhood says, that dog is making for that second story window. This is a nice neighborhood. That dog is wrong. If the dog gets his paws on the sill of the window, which is attached to the same room where the woman is opening her hatchet box, she may chop at his paws with that same hatchet. She might want to chop at something. It is, after all, getting close to chopping time. Something is dreadful. I feel a sense of dread, says that same person passing in the neighborhood. It's that dog that's not right. Not that way. In the room attached to the window that the dog has been making for, the woman is beginning to see two white paws on the sill of that same window, which looks out over the neighborhood. She says, it's wrong. Something, the windowsill. Something, the windowsill. She wants her hatchet. She thinks she's going to need it now. The person passing in the neighborhood says, "Something may happen. That dog. I feel a sense of dread." The woman goes to her hatchet in its box. She wants it, but it's gone bad. It's soft and nasty. It smells like something that's lost its ghost. She wants to get it out of its box, that same cedar box where she keeps it, but it bends and runs through her fingers. Now the dog is coming down, crouched low to the wall, backwards, leaving a wet streak with its tongue down the side of the house. And that same person passing in the neighborhood says, "That dog is wrong. I don't like to see a dog get like that. It's not over yet."
That poem is so strange. It's like delightfully strange.
It's so strange.
I love
it. Isn't it the strangest poem you've ever heard?
It's
yeah.
So weird.
It's one of my desert island poems, just because, you know, so many people try to write this kind of strange just for the sake of strange, like, oh, there's an elephant and the casino
right.
teller is sneezing and the elephant is barking, you know, and just saying random shit. Something about this poem that makes it so uncanny and so strange is the way that it's almost a suburban
yes.
scene, you know,
yes.
it's almost like Step 40ian, you know?
Yes. I think uncanny is the perfect word. I mean, I love the idea of the uncanny, like this thing that's just a little bit off
yeah.
from what you are used to, you know? And I think that,
yeah.
that
yeah.
is kind of like the uncanny valley, you know? It's
yeah.
just like, that's what makes it so uncomfortable because you almost recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because like you're saying, it's not randomly strange. It's like, it feels like allegory, but then it's also just has these elements of such,
yeah.
like just the bizarre that you can't quite place necessarily easily into
yeah.
allegory, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the woman saying that dog, I don't like to see a dog get like that.
Yes.
It's like, I don't like to see a dog get like that is like what you might say if a dog is feral or if someone is like spoiling
right.
their dog. You know, I've read this poem a million trillion times and talked about it a million trillion times. Like, it's just like, it stirs me up, you know, like it activates something inside me.
Yeah.
The way that it is strange is like, shaped exactly like the keyhole of my brain. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, when I started this poem, I remembered seeing like in New York once, this squirrel walking on the side of like a stucco apartment building and having the same reaction. I don't like to see that. I don't like to see a squirrel like that.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm implicated.
Yeah, because my spouse and I were both poets. My spouse is transcendent American poet Paige Lewis, and we both like are constantly reading each other poems. And this was a poem that I think I discovered it fairly early in our courtship or relationship or whatever, marriage. So we are constantly referencing it, you know, like we're constantly saying like, it's chopping time, it's almost chopping time. Or like, we'll say like, I don't like to see an ex get like that. Like if there's like a car that's like falling apart, I'll be like, I don't like to see a car get like that. Or Paige will be like, I don't like to see a shopping cart get like that, right? It's sort of one of our little go-to.
Just a great way of describing something that just, it's just making you feel uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah, it's just unsettling. Like that
yeah.
squirrel shouldn't be able to be lateral on the stucco like that.
It should not. It should not.
Yeah.
And I still think about
yeah.
it sometimes.
Yeah, I think what yeah. I love about the poem so much is that it's irreducible. You know, it's not a short poem, but every piece of it contributes to that strangeness, you know, like the strangeness early in the poem of sort of establishing her going to the hatchet box
right.
sets you up for when she finally picks up the hatchet and then it runs through her fingers.
Yeah.
Like it's something that's lost its ghost. What?
I'm like, it's what? Like at first you're like, sure, that smell, because everything else has been so concrete. And then it's like, wait, what is that?
Yeah, it smells like something that's lost its ghost. It almost
sneaks up on you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Literally, like it's like you read it and you're like, okay, yep, like something that's lost its ghost. Uh-huh.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And then you're like, wait a minute, you know, like it comes back from behind, you know?
Yeah.
And then you can break it to like something that, so everything has a ghost.
Right.
And then the loss of that ghost creates a smell. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's one of those things that like the more you look at it, the more complicated it gets.
And then
you know?
a hatchet has a ghost. The hatchet, so every object,
yeah.
not just like humans, animals,
yeah.
plants, every object has a ghost and has the ability to like go off. like all that hatchet, it's not good anymore.
Yeah, it's lost its ghost. It smells like something that's like, it's gone bad. Yeah.
I don't like to see a hatchet get like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the woman's reaction, honestly. It makes sense. The other element about it that I think is interesting in terms of its strangeness and how it works, it doesn't feel random, is that I can see how this could be like a commentary on like a surveillance state or policing even, you know? Like it's almost there. So it's like there's like these threads that you can tie in to like this social commentary, but it doesn't like insist on that either.
100%.
It's just possible.
Yeah, yeah. I think undoubtedly you could say it's inflected by the atmosphere of a surveillance state. It's just general sort of tension, even among, you know, households and neighbors, and that Edson was breathing, right? I'm sure that one could write a very, very compelling essay being like, well, the woman represents this and the dog represents that. And, you know, and I've never been particularly interested in that kind of forensic reading of poems. But certainly there's a mood here, right? There's a mood. And again, there's a lot of doors that a reader can open. If a person walks into this poem feeling claustrophobic because of maybe a history of domestic abuse, right? I think that there's a way in which you could read this poem as a text that is speaking to that. If someone walks into this poem with a history of racialized violence, I think that there's something in this poem that speaks to that, right? If someone is just feeling ill, like their body is ill-fitting in a particular day, if they're feeling kind of dysmorphic, right? That feels lucky and magical to me when a poem can be all of those things to all of those different kinds of readers without just being so nebulous as to be like, you know, sort of just nothing, right? Like this poem is concrete and it lives in the world of images. It's not just this nebulous cloud of language that doesn't have any real center, right? But
right.
I think it is expansive in its sort of generosity to its readers, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting how there is something at stake, but the possibility of what's at stake is multiple, you know?
That's a gorgeous way to say it. That's a perfect way to say it.
Yeah. So I want to say thank you so much for talking to us during this time when you're traveling so much for your book, you're on tour. I'm sure that you're basically busy all the time with readings for the tour for Martyr, but are you thinking about what's next for you writing-wise? Are you working on something now? Or are you taking it? You can take a break, too.
Yeah. Yeah, no, sure. No, it's a generous question. And I'm so grateful to be here. I love your mind for poetry and have for a long time. And
Thank you. It's
my luck to get to be here and sort of chopping it up with you about poems. But yeah, I am always writing. I'm someone who always writes, and the vast majority of what I write, I never show to anyone. You know, a small percentage of that I show to my spouse, and then a much, much smaller percentage of that I show to the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my luck to get to be here.
Yeah, it's been a delight. So we have something special for our listeners, thanks to you, the first 12 listeners to drop us an email at theglimpsepoetrypodcast@gmail.com with Martyr in the subject line. We'll get a copy of this book. So please do that. Please send us an email. Don't forget to send us your name in the email and your mailing address so we can actually send it to you. And that's at theglimpsepoetrypodcast@gmail.com with Martyr in the subject line.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for helping us to make that happen. And I hope they will enjoy your prose as much as I've been enjoying it.
Thank you for saying that. It's my luck to get to be the beneficiary of your attention.
Well, it's been a delight. Delightfully strange.
My favorite kind of delight. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I hope that we'll speak again soon.
Thanks so much, Camille. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm your host, Camille Rankin. Kaveh's poem, Reading Farrokhzad in a Pandemic, from his book Pilgrim Bell, copyright 2021, was aired with permission from Grey Wolf Press. Russell Edson's poem, Neighborhood Dog, appeared in The Tunnel, Selected Poems, copyright 1994, and was aired with permission of Oberlin College Press. Coming up next week, Hafeeza Jeter touches on grief, her love of Carl Phillips, and his masterful use of the line break. Make sure to like and subscribe to The Glimpse wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find episodes on our website, brinkerhoffpoetry.org. If you have any questions or comments, please drop us an email at theglimpsepoetrypodcast@gmail.com. The Glimpse is a production of the Adrian Brinkerhoff Poetry Foundation. I'm your host, Camille Rankin. Our senior producer is Jennifer Wolf. Kat Yore is our technical director and mixing engineer. Editorial director Amanda Glassman is our curator and production coordinator. Amy Holmes is the foundation's executive director, and our co-founders are Kathy and Peter Halstead. Thanks for listening.